Good evening and welcome. It's KVCR. I'm David Fleming. The sole focus of tonight's program is conversation with Dweezil Zappa. The Frank Zappa album Hot Rats came out in 1969 and was dedicated to Dweezil, born the same year. His current tour is called Dweezil Zappa, Hot Rats Live, plus other Hot Stuff 1969. Tonight we'll hear about some of Dweezil's early days as a guitarist, we're talking age 12 here, which includes getting some time with Eddie Van Halen. We'll hear about some of his early videos as well, but speaking primarily about the current tour and the music of Hot Rats.
I think more effective when you can showcase it for such a big anniversary. We've played a lot of the material from the album, but we've never played the entire album until now. And my dad never played some of the songs that were on the record, such as Little Umbrellas and It Must Be a Camel. So those songs are pretty cool to be able to bring to the stage, and the textures of those songs are so interesting. It Must Be a Camel is definitely one of the ones that is kind of an underexposed song. I don't know that people really give that one as much attention as other things in my dad's catalog, but when you really pay attention to it, it's one of the most interesting pieces of music that he ever wrote, in my opinion. It's got some just really cool air ballad melody stuff in it that is very different from his other work.
Speaking of material, it's always a treat to see you do Peaches and Regalia. And so as far as learning Hot Rats, this would be a wonderful one to tackle first melodically, but I could also see sort of a mid-80s Dweezil, if you will, going after something like Willie the Pimp, the more of the chordal kind of thing. What did you hit first from this as far as learning it? You've been doing Peaches and Regalia for a long time.
Yeah, we definitely had been playing that one for a while, but when it came time to getting ready for the album, I spent most of my time on Little Umbrellas and It Must Be a Camel, because the textures of those songs and learning the melodic parts that I chose to play on guitar that were previously played on organ or some other instruments, like on It Must Be a Camel has some violin parts and other things, you know, those things take time to develop the right kind of sound, and then also a lot of times when something's not written for guitar, it's much more difficult to play on guitar. So the overall challenge for Hot Rats, beyond just learning the notes, really comes down to the fact that it has such a classic album sound. You know, it's so evocative of a 60s sound. The lead guitar stuff that's on the record, like on Green Jeans and Willie the Pimp and stuff, has these different kind of fuzz tones mixed with clean, mixed with wah-wah, sometimes other things. And so the real detail work that we do to try to make the live presentation evocative of the album itself, that takes a lot of time as well. So what I'm trying to say is that we don't try to modernize the sound and say, oh, we're playing it 50 years later and we're doing what we want with it. We're playing it 50 years later and trying to make it sound as close to the record as we possibly can.
On the original album, we had Ian Underwood performing the roles of several musicians, either through dubs or live, much like we see Sheila Gonzalez do. So you did end up substituting some instruments for others. How many people are in this band, by the way? Because I think with a band smaller than 10 or 12 people, you would have to be substituting things.
Yeah, there are certain things that get substituted, but with technology, you can stack sounds, you know, with MIDI keyboard stuff. So we can get arrangements that fill out the textures that are on the record, but, you know, choosing to play the guitar to do certain things that it didn't previously do adds another element to the visual aspect of seeing the stuff performed, because you know, you can't really see over the keyboardist's shoulder, so it's more interesting to see when complicated parts are seen right in the front of the stage as well. So the band is a six-piece band, but we cover a lot of range because there's orchestral elements that come in and out of a lot of my dad's music, and some of those kind of woodwinds and other things that are on the record, you know, including different organs and keyboards. A lot of that stuff can be stacked, and there's three people playing different keyboard parts. We do cover a huge amount of the range of the instrumentation amongst the keyboards, as well as adding the guitar.
Oh yeah, you certainly do. I'm glad you brought up the word orchestral, because I was trying to describe this era or this album and things like King Kong also would be a great example, the Jean-Luc Ponty album, as orchestral jazz fusion. So let's talk about these multi-instrumentalists for a second. Sheila Gonzalez, I was excited to see her on one of the promo pictures because I'd seen some of the Zappa Play Zappa stuff in the past. And so she blew me away on that. And she's certainly not the only multi-instrumentalist playing with you and for you. But let's start with her. Where did you find this woman? And my God, how many things does she play for you?
Well, she auditioned back when I started the band in, I guess it was late 2005 or something was when the audition took place. But she was previously unfamiliar with my dad's music.
Oh.
And just sort of had to dive into it. And she had the right kind of personality and musical skill to be a good fit. You know, so for example, her audition was to play keyboards, saxophone, flute, clarinet, all on Peaches on Regalia, but unaccompanied, you know, so I wanted to see, like, okay, play all the parts. And she could have split it up and played them, you know, separately, but what she did, not thinking that this was unusual, was that she played the song from top to bottom and just picked up different instruments, leaving out only the last couple of notes, which gave her enough time to move from one thing to another. So it was almost like a vaudeville act, because she just switched from one thing to another. And I laughed because I didn't specify that that's how it should be done. She just thought, well, I got to play the whole song all without, you know, like missing a beat as much as possible. So once I knew that she had that kind of ability or that kind of thought process, then it became fun to find things to challenge her with. And she's been in the band since the beginning. So throughout the years, during solos and things, I'll interrupt her and ask her to do other things, you know, just as a surprise element. So sometimes she's played two or three horns at once and then switched to, like, every instrument. Like, there's been times where I've made her play guitar, bass, drums, keyboards, you know, like just everything during one solo thing, you know, and pretty funny. So she's got a lot of musical range, but, you know, her main instruments are the brass, and she plays flute really well and keyboards. She plays a little bit of guitar on Green Jeans during the show. So there's just little bits and pieces of things that she's always doing.
Wow. When you first started talking about her playing these, all of the instruments for the song, I first had a vision in my mind of Rahsaan Roland Kirk playing the instruments at the same time. Any time she's ever done anything like that? Do you know what I'm talking about there?
Yeah, she's definitely done that, like two or three horns at the same time. So we've had to help her do that and hold a particular horn, you know.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's like it becomes like a full-on octopus procedure, but it's pretty fun.
Nice, nice. Well, how about the other folks in the band?
Well, we have Adam Minkoff as the lead vocalist. He's able to cover a wide range of vocals, from all of my dad's vocals all the way through to anything that Ray White or Ike Willis would have done.
Oh, wow. That's a range.
And the sound of his voice is like an authentic blues gospel style voice, but then he can also get the mannerisms and delivery of my dad's vocals, which it's pretty amazing for that kind of range. But he also plays bass guitar, drums, keyboards. You know, he'll pick up any instrument and just start doing things with it. So he's another one where I'll interrupt him and have him do things. You know, one of the things that we've been doing that's been a kind of funny thing, we invoke the spirit of Johnny Guitar Watson, and he becomes Johnny Guitar Watson, and then we have Johnny Guitar Watson do things that you wish you would have been able to see Johnny Guitar Watson do. So sometimes, you know, I'll just request that he plays certain songs, and it can be anything from, like, Night Rangers, Sister Christian, to, you know, anything, Rocket Man from Elton John, but he'll do it in the style of Johnny Guitar Watson, and that could happen at any point, so it's funny.
Still with the Hot Rats tour, I know better than to ask about somebody seeing this in Pasadena. They certainly won't be seeing the same show in Agora Hills and again in Montclair, because Frank's music was very specific in ways, but also built for improvisation. But you'd have to be doing some sort of a set list if you're doing Hot Rats. Is it pretty much an act one, Hot Rats the album, and then act two, that's where you go with the other?
Yep, that's how it works. And since we've been doing this tour since last year, you know, the second half of the show has changed each leg of the tour, so it's about to change again. And as you were saying, you know, the music is designed to have improvisational sections, which even if you are playing the same set list or similar set list every night, the improvisational sections will be different, so you would never really see the same show. And that's really a pretty interesting thing about my dad's music in general, is that if you're the audience, you're seeing something that's unique to you that night, and that's why he was so heavily bootlegged.
Yeah, wow, nice point. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Dweezil Zappa, speaking mainly about his current tour, Dweezil Zappa Hot Rats Live, plus other Hot Stuff 1969. The tour has a couple of stops in our area. More at dweezilzappa.com. I'd like to, if you would, step back a bunch of years to a drastically different style of playing for you. You were playing stuff much more akin to Eddie Van Halen or Zakk Wylde, or if I could just say that type of music, which I loved in the 80s as well, okay. But I know that you did play some of your father's pieces on earlier Dweezil Zappa discs. But when you were getting ready to get the Zappa Plays, Zappa Tour going, was there a period of having to unlearn or abandon any of your own manner of playing?
Well, you know, the thing is, there's a couple different schools of thought. And so in the world of rock guitar, there's a guitar hero aspect to the whole thing. And my dad was sort of the antithesis of that. He had the ability to have this rock and roll presentation, but he made fun of the notion of it being like, oh, let's take myself really seriously as a rock and roll guitar player, you know? He just really had this idea of being a spontaneous composer and used the guitar as his instrument. So I was aware of this idea growing up, but I wasn't able to necessarily completely tap into what that was, because to do what my dad did, you have to have a huge musical vocabulary. You have to have knowledge of all the different harmonic colors, you know. And so over a period of years, as I learned more, I was able to incorporate more of a vocabulary. But at the point where I decided I wanted to do a tour where I was going to play my dad's music, I wanted to specifically play it in a way that was as close to an apples-to-apples comparison. So what that really meant as far as guitar playing was that I had to really, kind of as you were saying, unlearn a certain way of playing, and it required me to learn new techniques, because a lot of the things I wanted to play in my dad's music, some of the hard melodies and things, required changing the way that my right hand picking would work and all that stuff. So I basically, it was the equivalent of like having a lobotomy and then retraining yourself. You know, because you have to completely abandon everything that you developed that became a natural inclination or skill set and just say, yeah, that's not how I do it anymore. You know, so imagine, like, for example, having to be aware of how you breathe or how you walk and say, I naturally do it like this, but actually I have to change it and do it a different way. So that was kind of the biggest challenge, more mental than physical, was to be able to incorporate these new things. But long story short, the new technique allowed me to develop a different kind of musical vocabulary and really alter the course of my playing so that I could play more of the melodies that I wanted to learn in my dad's music, but also play more solo. Like, I could improvise much more freely and have a bigger vocabulary rhythmically within all of that. So it's still an ongoing process, but, you know, for sure one would hear a big difference in what I do now versus what I did when I was 15 and starting making records.
Yeah. So past interviews with you, and I cringe every time I have to say, I've heard somebody ask you many times, just what is it like to grow up in the house of Frank Zappa? And a lot of it, of course, is do your homework, please. Can I go to the mall? That kind of thing. It was normal stuff. But there were some things. When Eddie Van Halen called the house and your mom had to get onto the phone and all that kind of thing, that back and forth, and then him even coming over. Do you mind sharing that story for us?
I was a big fan of Van Halen and had just really started playing guitar only, you know, a few months prior to we received a phone call, and it was a guy purporting to be Edward Van Halen. Now, this was before MTV and any kind of internet thing where you could know much about an individual's, you know, speaking habits and, yeah, and everything. Like, you know, you would only know people from pictures on records or maybe if you heard them in an interview on the radio or something like that. So it's everything is completely left to your imagination at this point. So somebody saying they're Eddie Van Halen, you have no idea if it's really Eddie Van Halen. How would you fact check it? You know what I mean? So my mom's saying, hey, some guy's saying it's Eddie Van Halen. And so, of course, my ears perked up. I'm like, what? And back then, you could have house phones where, you know, there was multiple locations where you could pick up the line and listen in from a different room.
Sure.
And so my only frame of reference, which, of course, I had no way of knowing whether it was even possibly Edward Van Halen speaking, but on the song Unchained from the Fair Warning album, Somebody says, come on, Dave, give us a break. And so, you know, it's like, well, that could either be the producer, which I would imagine it's actually the producer saying that, but who knows? Could have been Ed, could have been Alex, could have been anybody saying that. But that's the only frame of reference that I would have had as an audio cue, you know. So listening to him talk for a second, and of course you want to believe as a 12-year-old, like, wait a minute, this could be Eddie Van Halen. So I'm like, I think it's him, you know. So my dad ended up getting on the phone with him. They talked for a little bit, and then, like, 15 minutes later, he was at our house. And it was the craziest thing because, you know, when he showed up, you know, it seemed for me like the vision of him walking up the stairs. It was like he was backlit with smoke machine and all this kind of stuff, like a superhero, you know, Hollywood-style entrance. But he was wearing the jumpsuit from the Women and Children First album cover. So, you know, it was like all of these things made it that much cooler. So he came over, and one of the first things that happened was that he ended up picking up a guitar. And I was like, okay, play Mean Streets, play Eruption. And so I got to see this stuff up close. And again, this is before, you know, being able to see this kind of stuff on YouTube. So to see that stuff and see how it was done, you know, that was like burned into my brain as a 12-year-old.
I saw some places crediting Frank with producing My Mother's a Space Cadet. But wasn't it actually produced by Ed?
Yeah, he produced it, and it was engineered by him and Don Landy, who did the early Van Halen records, and it was done at our home studio, the studio that my dad built. It's called the UMRK. It was actually one of the first couple of things that was recorded in the studio, because the studio was only recently completed at that time, like back in about 1981 is when it was really kind of up and running, and then we made that in like 1982. But Edward had to use a pseudonym because of his recording contract, so it was credited as DeVard. Produced by DeVard. I don't know what that's a reference to, but that's what it is.
When you hear My Mother's a Space Cadet, like these days as a 50-year-old, when you hear this, do you cringe or do you deconstruct it and analyze what you might have done as a player today? You know, because we're talking, of course, about a 12-year-old Dweezil versus a 50-year-old.
Well, it's funny because there's a certain element of freedom to it, especially the song Crunchy Water, which is a strange arrangement of stuff. I still actually get a kick out of both songs. But the experience of recording the stuff and learning about how to work in the studio and do overdubs, like, I had never done any of that stuff before. So Edward Van Halen was showing me, like, okay, so if you're going to punch in, and then I'm like, we've got to stop you there. What's punch in? You know, it's like you have to explain. You play along, and then the engineer will press play and record while you're playing along, and you can fix parts or change parts. But you have to play along with the part that you were playing before, so it's a seamless transition. That's something that people struggle with or used to struggle with a lot. These days, it's done differently with a computer, and you don't have any problems. You know, that would have been considered a destructive recording method, because if you had a part of something that you wanted to keep, but somebody punched in too soon, they ruined the part you liked. And that kind of stuff would happen all the time, you know. So that's why you had to sort of make sure that you were playing along to whatever came before, so that if somebody punched in early, you would still have the thing or close to the thing that you liked before. You know?
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Dweezil Zappa. His current tour is called Dweezil Zappa Hot Rats Live plus Other Hot Stuff 1969 and has a couple of stops in our area. More at DweezilZappa.com. Later, working with Frank Zappa alumni, as well as working with Pat Boone. First, though, an early video for Dweezil of a Frank Zappa cover. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. One of the covers of Frank's material that you did much earlier was My Guitar Wants to Kill Your Mama. And I bring this up because there's a video for this which I would compare to a Russ Meyer film, okay? Mm-hmm. Was this your idea of it? Somebody else produced it and came to you with the notion of this, let's do this black and white film noir kind of thing. Whose notion was this? How did this one come together, please?
Jeff Stein, who is a film director who did the movie The Kids Are All Right, the Who film, and he did a bunch of very popular videos in the 80s. We got together and came up with a storyline, and there's all kinds of quirky little things in there. All the videos I made for my music had Robert Wagner in them. And so Robert Wagner is a detective. He's Detective Dick Nose in that one. But there's other cameos in there. There's the actor Michael Nouri. He's my cellmate when I'm in jail there. And he has a tattoo on his forehead that says, I hate guitar solos. And that's when I start playing the guitar solo and he goes crazy. So...
That's funny. That is funny. Okay, yes. And I recall Robert Wagner in the Let's Talk About It video with you and Moon and your dad, then just reading the newspaper. Okay, wow. That's, I'm just going to have to go back to all of the early videos and just watch for the cameos now, and I suggest other folks do the same.
Well, one of the best ones was, there's a video called Gotta Get to You, and Robert Wagner is in that. He gets revealed later on because in the video I got to use the actual costume of H.R. Puffin Stuff. So H.R. Puffin Stuff is walking around, and then at the end of the video he takes off the head, and it's Robert Wagner in the H.R. Puffin stuff. So, you know, it's pretty good.
That is too good. That's great. Okay, another slight sidebar. I was able to interview Bobcat Goldthwait 2-3 years ago, and I completely forgot to ask how he ended up on Having a Bad Day. This was your first full album release.
Mm-hmm.
So since I forgot to ask him, I'll say, Dweezil, how'd Bobcat Goldthwait end up on Having a Bad Day?
Well, he's on the song called I Want a Yacht, which is from the album Having a Bad Day. And I had gone to see some of his comedy shows and kind of got to know him a little bit. And the song I Want a Yacht was based on the fact that a family relative once was calling the house. This is somebody that we did not usually spend any time with because they were usually off the rails. So at this one particular moment, this relative had called up and, for no apparent reason, just screamed into the phone, I want a yacht! So that became the song. I Want a Yacht. It was based on that. And since Bobcat Goldthwait, his character would be a little bit manic and then start yelling things.
Yes.
It seemed like the appropriate way to bring that song to life.
We're going to be yachting in Alaska. Oh, we're going to be yachting in the USA. I want a yacht! Thank you very much.
Ever so briefly on that album, I do remember you stated somewhere on the back or on the inside sleeve that your dad did not play on any of this. I want to even remember it with an exclamation point or three and in bold, maybe. But I know you've ended up on several of his albums, but did he ever end up on any of your recordings later?
No.
Okay.
There was a thing that he was going to play on, that this piece of music that I'm still working on. I started it 20-plus years ago. Which is called What the Hell Was I Thinking? But this one piece of music I wrote for him to play on, but he was too ill to play. So we tried to get it set up, but he just never felt comfortable to play because it was just, he just didn't feel good when the guitar was in his lap and, you know, all that stuff. So, unfortunately, he didn't end up getting to play on it, but I played over the section and I purposely tried to do something strange, which was limit myself to only one string. I took all the strings off the guitar and left just the D string.
Whoa.
And played a solo with just one string.
Did this develop something new for you, this working on it with the one string?
It definitely gave me a different way of thinking about playing because you have to phrase differently and you can only go after certain things because you only have the one string.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point, was to try to play in a way that I wouldn't play otherwise. And it turned out to be a really cool solo. But yeah, I think the whole idea of the way that I visualize playing the guitar really came from me teaching myself and looking at each individual string and trying to see what patterns are needed to stay diatonic, you know, in any particular scale, and then realizing, wait a minute, these same exact patterns exist in octaves on other strings. So, you know, once you see it in one place, if you just adjust to the octave on the other string, it's the exact same shape. So it became this visualization thing that helped me map out the fretboard and see things more clearly for myself. And then when I show people this, the way that I look at it, it's always this eye-opener for them. They're like, wow, I never even thought of it that way, you know, but I thought it was just being really normal and like, oh, everybody must know this, but apparently not.
You were speaking of visualization of shapes, and I'm not sure if a person who's not a guitar player can totally grasp that. I know what you're speaking of. You're talking about just instead of looking at rote memorization of the notes on each string, on each fret, instead looking at patterns that repeat, you're actually looking at a shape on the fretboard below you.
Yeah, so it's basically the distance between the fret on the guitar, you know. So scales are usually either going to have a half step or a whole step or combinations of, and sometimes you can have a 3-fret span or more. It just depends on what kind of scale you're playing. But when you have all of those millions of combinations, it becomes daunting for your mind to be able to remember how to do this stuff. So I simplified it by just trying to, at one point, look at one string at a time and seeing, like, okay, how many things can be symmetrical from one string to the next, meaning that you just put your fingers in the same place on each string. And from there, it just got extrapolated out to see, like, how many times that repeats on different string sets where it's identical. Because if you already know one pattern, then it's exactly the same on these other strings. So now you don't even have to tell yourself that you're learning anything new, you know. So it reduces it all to, like, oh, this is just the same thing that I do over here, you know, and your brain figures it out really quickly.
Listening to KBC Arts on 91.9 KBCR, streaming at kbcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, it's conversation with Dweezil Zappa. We heard about his current tour, Dweezil Zappa Hot Rats Live, plus other hot stuff 1969. This does have a couple of stops in our area. We also heard about his earliest of days as a guitarist, now somewhere in between, including just a bit of his television work.
Well, we all came out to Montreux on the Lake Geneva shoreline to make records.
Another past interview of mine that included you in a way, Pat Boone. I've interviewed him a couple of times, and the first time I spent half of my allotted time talking about No More Mr. Nice Guy, Pat Boone in a metal mood, as he says it.
Yep.
And so, until quite recently, though, I didn't know that you had the guitar lead on his Smoke on the Water.
Smoke on the water, a fire in the sky. Smoke on the water.
So, much like the Bobcat thing, how did you end up with a gig with Pat Boone? Diametrically opposed musical styles, I don't care where it is.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny because during the time of the PMRC and all that in the 80s, when there was the music censorship and all that, Pat Boone, who was very conservative, was not really out there that much, but he was more on the side of the senators' wives, you know, who were doing the PMRC stuff. So it wasn't too long after that whole period of time that he decided to make a metal album, which was kind of like really rocking the boat for him, you know. I think a lot of people got concerned, like, whoa, what are you doing? And somehow or another, I received a call to play on that. And it was actually one of the most fun things to do, you know, because it was a live session with a big band, you know, like a bunch of horns and the whole thing. And we just did a single performance of this thing. And he did it in his kind of Sinatra-esque style, and I actually thought the record was pretty hilarious. I thought the arrangements were good, and I liked that he had a good sense of humor about it. And that's the one thing that was great about him, was that he was very personable. He had a good sense of humor about the stuff, and even though he might have originally seemed like somebody that I would have not gotten along with based on, like, my family's stance on, you know, the censorship and all that kind of stuff, you know, none of that stuff mattered because, like I said, it seemed like a really bold step for him, and I looked at it as, you know, something that was fun and entertaining, and it turned out to be good. I even played on The Tonight Show with him.
When he showed up in the leather vest and everything?
Yeah, I recall having to play on Smoke on the Water at some point on a live show, you know.
Wow. You've shared the stage with many Frank Zappa alumni, many joining you for your tours, but is there any one alumnus, or maybe even are there any alumni, former mothers, or people from the past bands, anybody that you would still really like to share the stage with?
It's never been important to me to have alumni be a part of any of this stuff. It was actually originally my goal to not use alumni at all, because there's sort of this fragmented thought from people that, you know, oh, you know, the only people that can play this music are people that formerly would have played with Frank.
Right.
And I don't see it that way because, you know, like, let's take an orchestra for an example. You know, you're going to play the music of Beethoven. How many orchestras have played that? You're playing the music. There's instructions on the page, and the musicians, you know, if they follow the instructions, should be able to play the music the way the composer intended. And it was important for me to say, hey, listen, if this music is going to go into the future, younger people need to understand that this is something they could learn or aspire to learn. And it's difficult to get a younger audience to want to pay attention to something if they're seeing people on stage that are what they would consider to be too old to be interesting to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so originally, I had very little interest in pursuing the alumni thing, but a lot of the promoters really wanted to see alumni, and they were trying to put it together in a way that was like a circus thing, like bring out as many as you can. And I'm like,
right.
You know, if that's the way you want it, then I'm not going to do it at all, because this is just not what's needed. So the first year I did have some alumni, and it was fun to be able to do that if that was the only way that we were going to do it. But essentially, I put together a core band of much younger musicians, and then we featured some of the alumni at different points in the show. So Napoleon was singing for some of the show, and Terry Bozzio came out and did some songs, and Steve Vai did a few songs. But essentially, it was my core band
right.
that was doing all of the heavy lifting. So as it continued on, I was using less and less alumni, and sometimes, you know, people would sit in here or there, and I've had some fun experiences with that, like Chester Thompson has played with us a few times in Nashville, and he was always one of my favorites to see play with my dad. But, you know, I think I've played with the people that I would be happy to play with.
Excellent.
And, you know, there's others that it's not important to me.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair, and it's nothing against anybody, and that was a really kind of a beautiful answer on that. I was excited to see on the Zappa Play Zappa DVD that I have. I was excited to see that Steve Vai and Napoleon Murphy Brock and Terry Bozzio would be on there. But I was also very happy to see that it wasn't a show about them. Steve came in and guested on just a song or two. So that was really nice, actually. It was your band with the occasional guest appearance. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Dweezil Zappa. His current tour is called Dweezil Zappa Hot Rats Live, plus other hot stuff, 1969, and has a couple of stops in our area. More at DweezilZappa.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 FM, also at KVCRnews.org. Speaking of Terry, and this goes back to a very musical thing, this has to do with Black Page. And I suppose I was thinking about this because we were talking about substitutions of instruments for other ones. Let's back it up with this. When I was doing a jazz fusion radio show, a friend of mine fell in love with Herbie Hancock's Chameleon, because I would just love to play it. And he wanted to use it for a dance piece he was choreographing, but his dancers couldn't get the complex rhythms. And so this leads, again, to Black Page. But to lead into this, can I ask you to describe for folks what a, quote, Black Page is?
Well, my dad composed a drum solo, and it was a piece of music that was, as he liked to call it, so statistically dense that when you looked at the notes on the page, they seemed so close together and so complicated that it was like a page with just blackness on it. So it became the Black Page, you know, because there were so many notes. And what's happening in that piece of music is there are a lot of polyrhythms and nested tuplets and things that are very, very complicated if you're trying to consider them against a just straight pulse in 4/4.
Yes.
You know, so some of these things get really, really hard to do. And it was originally sort of set up as a challenge for Terry to play. And when he was able to play it, then my dad thought, well, you know, maybe I should write a melody to this. And so that's also interesting because he had originally just written only the drum line for it. So it was all the percussion, and then he added notes to the existing rhythms. And it is, in my opinion, maybe the most iconic melody of his entire catalog. You know, there's a few contenders for that spot, but this is one, and it's just such a unique composition. you know, that one is one that is also bewildering for anyone who has to try to play the melody, because it's very difficult. And my dad once said, well, somebody asked him, have you ever witnessed a miracle? And he said, yes, one of my bands played the Black Page correctly once.
Deadpan delivery, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Is this by chance the song or the melody that was Terry's infamous audition piece, Terry Bozzio? Was it actually this one? Because I know it was a very tonal exploration that Terry had to audition with.
I'm not sure. I would have to do some research. But I do know that Terry, in speaking about his audition, he said that he was waiting around in this room and he was watching other people audition. And as he was seeing it happen, he's like, I have no business being here. I'm never going to get this gig. This is way too hard. And he tried to get up and leave. And he had apparently been wearing a trench coat. And my dad noticed him. He said, hey, where do you think you're going? And he made him sit back down, and like two drummers later, it was Terry's turn, and then he ended up getting the gig. But it's one of those things where sometimes musicians struggle with the idea that they have the required skills to do something, you know? And when it comes to my dad's music, a lot of people used to try to audition just so they could put it on their resume that they auditioned, even if they had no chance at getting the gig. Mm. It gave the appearance that they were good enough to audition for Zappa. Mm. So therefore, oh, hey, you must be good, you know? But anyway, my dad was really good at seeing things in other people that they couldn't see within themselves. And Terry was a good example of that, you know? Yeah. Sort of pushing him in different directions. But one of the things that made him change to the way that he plays now and the kind of kit that he plays is that he used to, when he played like a traditional style drum set, at one point my dad said, why do you always play so many cymbals in my music? That sort of struck Terry in a way that made him decide that he didn't want to have so much sustaining cymbal stuff. And so he changed the way his kit is. So there's very little sustain to any of the hardware type of stuff that he's hitting, because he was trying to go the opposite route of traditional cymbals, you know. So I still think it would be nice to hear him on a traditional kit again sometimes, you know, but I like what he does.
I love what he does. It would be interesting to hear him suddenly without all that and see what kind of tones he finds just within one rim.
Mm-hmm.
Away from music for just a second, and that is, folks, if they just go to IMDb, you'll see kind of an extensive list of appearances or sitcoms or even the cooking show with Lisa way back when. But the one that I'm going to ask about is Duckman, okay? You were the voice for Ajax Duckman. Mm-hmm. So I want to know if there was a direct inspiration for him. That is to say, the voice, was that based off of anyone? It always felt to me a lot like Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
It's definitely in that range, and that was one of my favorite movies growing up. So, of course, that would have had an influence on what kind of voice that teenage duck would have, but it was a fun project to work on. The Klasky Csupo animation team had some sort of connection to my dad's work because they were big fans. And if I'm recalling correctly, they're either from Hungary or Czechoslovakia or somewhere nearby. And my dad's music was popular in those areas because if they could get records, they were coveted because they had great repeat listening value, you know, because you could listen to them for years and always find new layers of detail. And so the fans from those countries back in the 60s and 70s were really into the music, even if they didn't understand the lyrics, but they just loved all that stuff. So that was kind of like a backdrop for a visual presentation for some of those guys. And originally, they had wanted my dad to do the theme song for Duckman or do some other music for it, but he just wasn't able to do that stuff at the time. He did a little bit of stuff for one episode, but there was a guy named Toddy Vega that ended up doing the majority of the music, and he was the guy that was working with my dad's Synclavier setup. Because of that, I think I got asked to do this voice, which it was a fun thing to do because Jason Alexander from Seinfeld was Duckman, and there were, you know, some other people that did guest appearances. The guy that was from the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Tim Curry?
Yeah, Tim Curry. He did a lot of voices on there, and one of the funniest things was at some point he was doing a character that was like an American politician, and so he had to do a really over-the-top American accent, which was funny in and of itself, but there was a point where he was asked to make reference to NASA, but he would always pronounce it NASA. And so that was really funny, but the producers were saying, okay, but try one where you say NASA. And he goes, oh, yeah, definitely. And he never would do it because he wanted to make sure that his pronunciation of NASA would be in there. So every time they asked, he'd go, oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. And he would say NASA every time. So it was genius to watch, to know that he knew what he wanted to hear for his own version of what he thought the comedy was. And he was right, by the way, but it was funny to watch him navigate that in that way.
That's beautiful. That was a fun show. I'd still go back to it every so often. Wrapping up the interview with how folks might see you wrap the show with the Hot Rats live tour, going full circle here. You did say that your act two, as it were, the stuff going away from the Hot Rats album, that is going through a change or goes through changes. Mm-hmm. Any standard favorites to close with that just have a good rap feel or seem to have resonated well with the audience?
You know, it just depends. There are some classics that people are familiar with. You know, people love Muffin Man as an ending. We've done that many, many times. On the very last run of the tour, we did more of a rare ending, which was Tears Began to Fall.
Mm.
But we've done all kinds of stuff. You know, this version of the next upcoming tour, maybe SOFA, the Live in New York version, might be the ending. But, you know, we change it up quite a bit. We've had all kinds of weird things in there. We've had Penis Dimension as the closer. We've had all kinds of stuff.
Once again, Dweezil Zappa, Hot Rats Live, plus other Hot Stuff 1969 has a couple of stops in our area. Pasadena, February 14th, and Montclair, February 16th. More at DweezilZappa.com. Thanks again to Dweezil Zappa, as well as to Megan Zappa for the arrangements. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Sharina Wadd. Tonight we heard music from Dweezil Zappa, though at times going to the recordings of Frank Zappa. That take on Tears Began to Fall came from The Mothers live at the Fillmore East, June of 1971. Other music beds and themes heard on KVCR's composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. Many past KVCR's can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.